You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Radio Tacoma, 101.9 LP FM. And we are Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. And today we have the pleasure of bringing Bethany Reed to the listeners, who, and that is spelled R-E-I-D, for those of you that don't know Bethany. She has been a teacher for 30 years at the Everett Community College. She has a poetry MFA and a PhD in American Literature from the University of Washington. Starting in 1990, she published her first poetry collection, Coyotes and My Mom, in 1990, that was. Other collections came as a chapbook, Be Careful. Sparrow won the Kenneth and Geraldine Gell Prize in 2012. Body My House by Goldfish Press of Seattle in 2018. And there are many others. She has many published in fine journals, but you can find them in Bethany's website, bethanyareed.com, which contains a rich miscellany of her writings, because she writes very interesting blogs and reviews of poetry, books, and other matters. Recently, she's been the 2023 recipient of the Sally Albiso Award from the Moonpath Press publication, The Pear Tree, Elegy for a Farm. So I'd like you to welcome Bethany Reed, and thanks very much for participating with Sound Poetry.
Thank you, David.
And so we're going to listen to poems performed from her book that is coming out soon, and The Pear Tree, perhaps an iconic symbol, many trees might be, and around this we are going to find a life that goes on a farm, as the elegy for a farm indicates. So if you'd wish, you can say anything you'd like about your happy feelings about winning the prize and about how this book came about.
Well, I'm thrilled to have won the prize. This is a book I've been working on at least since my father died in 2010. My dad was a logger, but we had about 160 acres of land. We had cows and trees. And with his sudden death at age 82, we knew we weren't going to be able to keep the farm. My mother had Alzheimer's, even at that point, and we pretty quickly moved her and had to clean out the farmhouse. So a lot of these poems are about cleaning out the farmhouse. Yes. I grew up in something like a family compound, because my grandfather's progeny had settled all up and down mm-hmm. Elk Creek Road. So we had many cousins of all ages who lived there. Not crammed together, but... So I'll read the first temptation. We lived on Elk Creek, 2 miles from the nearest town, Doty, with its clapboard churches, its post office in the back of the general store, plank floor pocked by spikes from loggers' boots. Elk Creek Road was packed gravel. Summers, trucks dumped more gravel, one truck coming behind spraying oil to settle the dust. Weeds crept up from ditches, horsetail, tansy ragwort, curly dock, Queen Anne's lace, which we called wild carrot, poison never to be tasted. We were allowed to ride our bicycles halfway to our cousin's house, and they could ride their bicycles halfway to ours. We scratched our names into the telephone pole standing there, its reddish trunk redolent of the tree it had been, and left little gifts, offerings of leaves and sticks. When the road was paved and striped, a solid yellow line, white dashes like a code, We felt as though our Eden had been violated, made up, dressed in a harlot's clothes. Traveling that road, how could we help but be tempted away?
So there is just a preview of the environment, the place that we're going to learn much more about, and the people who inhabited this community. We'll go on with the cow. We'll go into the husbandry of...
Yeah, I wasn't sure I wanted to include this poem, but this uncle died only a few days ago. And he didn't keep gamecocks all the time, by the way, but at one time he did, and I remember them. The cow who dreamed of the moon. Your uncle's black cow is the cow that jumped over the moon. Ask Mother Goose, ask Chagall, though she lands on the other side of fence after fence, fences were never her aim. On the scrubby hillside above the barn, your uncle's gamecock strut, feathers of magenta, turquoise, cerise, halcyon blue, cocks strolling, cockadoodling as they stretch razored talons. Cockfighting breeds a bird to a love so pure it will kill to have it. The cow's udder hangs pendulous, plump as a balloon, an udder so moonlike itself the cow can't help leaping over her own reflection on the creek's satin surface. She's a cow to bring in the next millennium, a moon-faced calf every winter for 1,000 years. Preposterous cocks, shaggy, dreaming cow, hill farm set like an Ibsen play, or make that Chekhov, his moon, his bridge of stars, tall fur with a cloud like a tendon in its beak. God damn, your uncle says, wiping his eyes, wiping the barrel of his rifle on his red plaid sleeve. God damn, he says, but she kept jumping that fence.
Allergy for the cow there. And isn't it wonderful to use colors that are, in poetry at least, they're off the normal color range. You start out with the magenta, well, turquoise, cerise, halcyon. Thing about color, have you enjoyed using, you use color quite a bit in your poems. What do you feel about the use of color in poetry?
I also write essays and stories. And so one of my mentors has taught me that working with color is a craft skill. And you have to cultivate it and practice it. So I do that. And I'm really pleased you noticed.
Well, yes, it is a motif mm-hmm. in many of your poems. But the one thing I think that is quite remarkable about using a color word in a poem is you don't have to describe it. You don't have to say more than the mm-hmm. color. Mm-hmm. And if the reader or the listener gets that, the brain just explodes in that color. That's
perfect.
All there is to it.
Perfect, yeah. 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 I found the same thing was true about working with smell. It's easier than it looks, because if you say ripe pear, everyone has a smell immediately. They know what that aroma is. This manuscript was originally in sections and had a different title. Even though I was working with an editor who thought sections were a good idea, I began to feel strongly that it shouldn't have sections, that there was something a little arbitrary about saying, well, here are the grandmother poems in this section, and here are the father poems, and here are the... Mm-hmm. And it felt more the way memory works, the way things come in and out of your mind. And I saw when I took out the sections that my grandmother, and especially this pear tree, could be the sort of the thread that bound the whole book together. And that's when I changed the title and almost immediately won the contest. So it must have been the right move.
Combination, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm.
So she was this incredibly important figure in my life. My mother was born in the house I grew up in. My grandmother had 15 children, raised them in that house. And then her sons-in-law, she had mostly daughters. Mm-hmm. There were 12 girls and 3 boys. But her sons-in-law built her a house just around the bend from us. So she was always present. My grandfather too, but especially her as the matriarch. So this poem is to carry on. My grandmother's name was Areta. In another language, fertile field. I am the second child of her 11th and grew up next door on the old creek road. When grandma was old, she took 6 pills a day, thought she saw babies on the chair, on the pillow, on the floor beside her bed. Careful, she said, don't sit on the baby. Her daughters cared by turns, moons orbiting a planet. From the threshold once, I heard her call, don't forget me. But I had already turned into the hall to a time before names were spoken. My aunts clucked their tongues and counted pills. She's never been sick except to have babies. They smoothed a blue blanket under her chin, smoothed back her black hair. When I dream my grandmother, my dream is a word from a wordless deep, a shaft of light. She is tiny and wrinkled. I wrap her in my arms. I bear her up the stair.
A very tender poem. And how old was your grandmother when she passed away?
88.
So they were just taking care of her when they smoothed back her hair and smoothed the blue blanket under her. It was just the caregiving that was going on there. Nothing more is implied. But after that, your dream is a dream of the grandmother who passed away. In the conclusion, right? And of course, it's a very dreamlike in your taking care yourself of her at that point, baby-like.
Yeah,
which you were told not to sit on the baby. So we get family members interspersed through here, which is a very good idea if you're going to give a well-rounded feeling and not to concentrate one subject where there might be repetition in that one subject because of a particular noun or verb or adjective that you associate with that. But when you then, it doesn't matter when the repetition comes a little later, if there is one, because it's not thought of or heard as a repetition so much. Yeah, better to keep them separate. And so once you go away from your grandmother, which is a good introduction really to this one, because you're going back now to childhood. The Kingdom of Childhood is number 4.
The Kingdom of Childhood. Childhood is the kingdom where nobody dies. Edna St. Vincent Millay. Hereford cow and calf. Tall brown grass clicking with insects, jab of barbs on a wire fence, creek rushing away, patch of blue sky over an ungrazed field, unglazed bowl blue, a rustic painting, acrylic on board, barn staggering under its gambrel roof, gambling calves, boards sinking, stink of barnyard muck, black boots with their one red stripe stuck in that memory, staccato bark of the farm dog, crescendo of bird call, gnarled apple trees draped in moss, honeybees on yellow and blue plum stains on the path, common pear tree, pyrus communis, well water, dark, deep, a child's reflected face, grass knotted with bullthistle, bumblebees burrowing into purple crowns.
Very childlike. You thought of the short verse perhaps because it would appeal also to children in the way nursery rhymes have a lot of music in them. You know, the hey diddle diddle type thing. The cow jumped over the moon, the one you had before. And you start out with Hereford cow and calf, which can't help but remind the reader of the cow that was jumping
that
over,
jumped
the
over the moon.
Right? But as we grow up, we learn poetry from infancy. That's our first language, really, is it not? The music of it is very, very important, which you have incorporated, exploited fully in the phrases
oh,
in
I'm
your,
glad you
your,
think
your,
so.
Your poem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a fine piece. Do you read this to children?
I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should.
Well, it certainly would fit in a library setting where they have you have children's reading time, mm-hmm. you know, to read that one particularly.
And I feel very fortunate that I had a father who read to us. Mm-hmm. We had the Childcraft books, and we have lots of pictures of all of us sitting on his lap, the three oldest sitting on his lap while he goes through a book. I recently inherited those Childcraft books, and they're filled with, you know, Christina Rossetti and Emily Dickinson.
Yes.
Robert Frost. It just amazed me that the poets that I was exposed to at a really young age.
Right. It's good that they put those in children's encyclopedias and in mm-hmm. in books for children.
Yeah. Yeah. Long There's ago. A whole volume of Mother Goose too, but to bless. My grandmother's pear tree shaded the path that led to the bee boxes. In late spring, a frenzy of blossoms, white like a wedding. In late summer, our barefoot dance, bees baptized in fallen bodies of pears. To bless comes from Old English bledsian, from Northumbrian blodsian, druids in moonlight, stones hallowed in blood. Our church's front doors opened on a vestibule, walls painted yellow as pollen, yellow as our honey, tasting of blossoms. In church, one blessing, hum of hymns washed in the blood of the lamb. On the path to the bees, another, the pear tree, limbs raised, bursting with bees.
Which is a fair introduction to the history of beekeeping that was common on your farm, too. You put in the etymologies there of the word to bless. Did you do that for its music, the language of it?
That was an interesting, I'll call it an exercise. Someone told me that the meaning of to bless includes the sacrifice part, the blood part, and I was doubtful, so I did my own etymological search, and as I started listing the words, I came across almost this feeling of the bees and the blessing, and so from then on I knew what the poem was about, and it wasn't just about the etymology of a word, but
yes,
these bees.
Mm-hmm. You have also a sort of ritual feeling in our barefoot dance, which mm-hmm. which then, after the etymologies, leads into the antiquity of druids in the moonlight. Again, the ritual comes to mind with druids, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And stones hallowed in blood, which, of course, fits perfectly. And then you bring that in later on, too. Perfect introduction to what you have in the blessing later on, one blessing. Of hymns, you have more ritual in the latter part of it too. Very good. Bursting with bees, all those lovely bee bombs.
the bee sounds.
Bursting with bees.
Yeah.
Yes. Another member of your family enters.
Well, in the longer book, my siblings are a little more introduced, but really of my two sisters and my two brothers, my brothers are the ones who ended up with a somewhat starring role. And this is my older brother, who I adored and still adore. Out of the furnace. We weren't Catholic, though looking back, I see him as a sort of priest. My red-headed older brother, tasked like some antique authority to know every twisted place, every disjointed thing, or how to disjoint it. When he picked up a daddy long legs, it pointed to the field where we'd find the cows. Red and black ants scooped into his rusty red flyer wagon, battled to the death. He'd sick our dog on any other dog that sidled past the gate, and cats landed always on their feet, no matter how many times he tossed them to the shed roof. In the trough where we cooled milk cans for the dairy, he baptized kittens in the name of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, I, his mute witness, altar girl to his every right. So it wasn't surprise that shot through me when he swung wide the furnace door, when he drew from his pocket a garter snake and flicked it into the coals. Did I see vestigial feet exposed as flames licked up, or was it only that I believed whatever my big brother told me to believe? It was biblical, he said, proving Genesis. If God cursed the serpent to crawl on its belly, then it must have once had feet. He told me that God had placed enmity between the snake and all of womankind, though I felt only pity for it, the garter snake burning that had never told me anything but truth.
Yes, those wise snakes can tell the truth. Why do you think a snake has the ability to tell truths? What was it that convinced you of that? Do you remember?
What a great question.
You can make up a story.
One of my cousins has a story about me being age 3 and taking a garter snake from my pocket and shaking it at my brother. And this cousin was older, and he said, your brother was afraid, but you weren't. And he says, I was in awe of you. But there, you know, something about being a child, just being low to the ground. But on the farm, there were just animals and bugs everywhere. And it made more sense to me to be a little scientist than to be afraid of anything.
Snakes play snakes very authentically, don't they?
They do. They do.
You are interested in Greek, too, because you've chosen poem with a word that certainly may not need explanation, but it is an interesting word. We hear it more nowadays, I think, than it used to be. Kairos.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which I think of as time outside of time, or maybe it would be better to say inside. Because it's not the chronology that where it keeps spinning, it's where you're
completely held. No, it's an unusual term. In the Greek, it indicated the appropriate time, the most fit time.
Mm-hmm.
Things happen in season, at a particular time, in a season. That's the kairos, the most optimum moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's
you recognize that moment, there's almost a kind of spell that gets
right. It is something of a coincidence and maybe epiphany. Yeah.
Kairos. Not time as kept by clocks or predicated on a sum like story problems in your arithmetic book. But time measured by dwindling summer creeks, by horsetail and Queen Anne's lace thick in the shaded ditches of unpaved roads. There is time in that time still for the canvas hammock strung between cherry trees, for rainwater's scent of rot and cherry bark, smoke in your eyes, your mongrel dog whining at the door, the rescued squirrel in the hamster cage on the back porch, speckled foal in your uncle's paddock. But here is where time breaks apart, seasons and years multiplied like X in your school equations, in current events, where presidents are shot, where soldiers escort children past barricades, women in pin curls like your mother's, twisting their mouths around hate, a man walking on the moon. Here time divides into halves, fourths, sixteenths, not time, but time, ticking and ticking, eyes staring up at you from shards of a shattered mirror.
Yes, the breaking things down. Also, the X multiplied like times.
Ah.
The X is also used for times. I didn't know whether I should say times or X there. But that's right. And the current events.
You just taught me something about my own poem. Thank you.
Well, there's always a possibility, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's a great symbol
mm-hmm.
for two different things. That mm-hmm. and the time element is one of those, because we do use it for times, multiplication.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so at the end, the shards of a shattered mirror, eyes staring up, things broken, shattered. The time marks those things.
To my mind, that holds this central or background event of the book, which is breaking up the farm and selling it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very sad and significant things mm-hmm. really impact feelings. Yes.
Thank you. Years before her death, we rode our horses through fields bright with dust and Canadian thistle to the creek. At the back of the farm, ancient alders and fir trees stood like caryatids holding up the sky. The horses waded to their bellies, plunging their noses where the pull of the creek was greatest. I looped my stirrups over the saddle horn to keep them dry. My cousin unfastened her hair, cupped a hand to the dark, mirroring water, lifted it to her lips. This is the dream of my childhood. All night I rein my bay horse back to that still place. All night I watch her reflection waver and beckon.
Your cousin is set there in a sort of iconic image, frozen in the slaking of her thirst. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a pretty vital image. You're in the water on an animal, and the action
mm-hmm.
is one that perhaps people have seen many, many times in imagery, in film, perhaps. But for you, this has become a dream moment.
It's interesting to read these poems back to back, and they turn out to be next to each other in the manuscript, but
mm-hmm.
both end with this reflection. There's a bit of a subplot about horses and, you know, when I get my first horse at age 12
mm-hmm.
that come before mm-hmm. this poem.
Right. So this is a cousin who has passed away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she and her sister live just up the creek from us, and they're the cousins who would meet us on their bicycles mm-hmm. halfway between houses.
Yes.
This is my younger brother. Genesis. Our younger brother once took apart 5 bicycles and reassembled them as one. Wobbling saddle, sprocket and gears misaligned, mismatched wheels, flap, flap of a pedal, loose fender, a cacophonous screech, a puzzle of a bike, leftover parts strewn across the floor of Dad's shop like bones and entrails. I could be remembering it wrong. Maybe it was 4 bicycles or 3. My point is, in another family, this story would preface a brother's brilliant career as an engineer or the best damned mechanic in Lewis County. Oh yes, people would say, even as a boy, he had a hunger to know what makes things tick. Instead, Matt is 30 years dead, and our family, pulled apart, is still put together all wrong.
Well, your memory can never be trusted, can it?
Mm.
But when you're putting these memories into poems, which choose words a little more strangely, and the syntax isn't always as you would tell it in a normal prose narrative,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you can't quite get it right. But to get it wrong gives
mm-hmm.
you something to write about in a
mm-hmm.
poem.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as you mentioned, the separation of things, you've got splitting apart and coming together here, an attempt to patch things together, though it's imperfect. It doesn't quite work. It's a bricolage that is never quite what the perfect combination could be
mm-hmm.
of things that are taken apart,
mm-hmm.
what's left over from the past. And you have that as your final line, that still put together all wrong.
It's been tremendously hard to let go of this manuscript. my mentor felt that it was ready to send out years ago, and I just didn't feel able to let go of it yet. And I think it's partly for that reason, because I'm trying to pull together something to make something whole again out of the loss.
Are the people in your family able to read them and help you as mentors? Or?
No. A lot of working class, very salt of the earth, wonderful people. I mentioned I went to a family reunion yesterday. No one said, "Have you written any poems?" So
sad.
I always try to just meet them where they are. But I have a wonderful poetry community, and they encourage me. In fact, I have a good friend who grew up in the same area, and I sometimes call him and say, "You know, I have a poem about cutting wood. I want to make sure I got it right."
Yes, that's right. And so you do have someone you can call up.
Yeah, good, and he worked as a logger as a young man. So yeah.
Who could smell the smells,
right?
and knew the way of cutting wood.
Right, right. In fact, he helped me with this next poem, Cutting Wood. Uh-huh. There was one detail. Of course, I grew up on wood heat, but there was one detail. He says, "I don't think that wood does that." And so I'm going to burn a piece of it and get back to you.
So experiment. Yes.
Right, right.
Good. That's good advice.
I'll read Cutting Wood. Cutting wood, chop your wood, and it will heat you twice. Old saying. My father used to say, a wood fire heats you many times. He meant not only the fire, but felling the tree, cutting logs into rounds, hauling the wood home to be split and stacked. As a girl, I was never good at chopping wood into furnace-sized chunks, could barely lift the big axe. My father aimed dead center, splitting apart even a knotted log with one blow. We had wild cherry from a storm-down tree, applewood smelled of rain, cedar made the best kindling, fir was pitchy and spat fire. In winter, we kids packed seasoned wood into the house, dropped it beside the fireplace. The logs are Larry's and Penates of the hearth. Whenever I lack the lightning bolt of inspiration, I recall my father, breath steaming in crisp air, shirt soaked with sweat over knotted muscles, heft and arc of his axe, swift stroke to heartwood.
So which was the type of wood that you had mistaken?
I had something about cedar spitting fire, and he said that's not right. And so he suggested I use fir. That fir was pitchy and spat fire.
Well, we have been listening here on Sound Poetry to the life in Lewis County, on the banks of the Elk Creek, and living with the family of Bethany Reed, her grandmother, her mother, her father, uncles, brothers, cousins, animals that she is fond of, and bees. But she has brought so much back to life that you can't help but feel invigorated from reading the poetry. Thanks for the elegies of a farm, and Bethany, it was a real pleasure.
Thank you. It was indeed a pleasure.